Hello. Today we examine conflict between China and the Soviet Union in 1969, and we see how America stepped into that dispute in October with its madman nuclear alert. It was today's special guest, Bruce Gordon, then a US Air Force fighter pilot, who inadvertently intervened in that Sino-Soviet spat.
They suddenly turned the big guns of that cruiser right at me.
What have you got in store for us in this month in history?
We're looking at war between the two communist giants, the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, a conflict which began in March 1969. And we're going to be joined by telephone by a special guest in the USA who, as a US Air Force pilot, found himself a bit too close for comfort to the Soviet fleet just off China's coast as they prepared to strike the mainland in 1969. Before we call up our guest, Bruce Gordon, let's understand the situation of what was going on at the time. So China in 1969, during the Cultural Revolution, of course, it was becoming increasingly militarized. Every leader was seen wearing military uniform everywhere, not just Mao, but even right down to including Mao's personal doctor, Dr. Li, who's written a good book, by the way, that tells us all about this. And Lin Bao, of course, Lin Bao was leading this kind of militarization process. He was officially, as of 1969, second in charge in China, to Mao, obviously. And the People's Republic was fed up with the declining support from the USSR. They had been getting economic and military support from the Soviet Union, but by the late 60s, the Soviet Union was less enthusiastic about that relationship, seeing China, and Mao in particular, as potentially unreliable kind of ally. You couldn't be too sure what he might do. And the leadership in Beijing saw the USSR as imperialistic, as a socialist imperialistic state, forever threatening expansion and seeing themselves as the world leader of communism, and that the other communist countries should sort of do what they're told by Moscow. The Soviet defense minister said to Zhao Enlai, China's foreign minister, late in 1964, actually, "We've got rid of our fool Khrushchev. Now you get rid of yours, Mao, and then we can have friendly relations again." So that saying that to Zhao Enlai, who was obviously incredibly close to Mao, was obviously in a private meeting, but still was very provocative. He had to later, the Soviet defense minister, kind of backtrack from that. But it gives an indication of how they were feeling. And the two nations had had no diplomatic relations for several years by 1969, the year we're focusing on today. In 1966, the Chinese had revived the old dispute of the Russo-Chinese border. And in 1967, Red Guards even attacked the Soviet embassy in Beijing. So things were bubbling up before we get to March 1969. But by then, Mao was really looking to beef up his personal strength. And one way to do that would be for a show of force against the Soviet Union. So he engineered a border clash in March 1969. There had been other clashes along that. There's the border, I believe, 7,000-kilometre border with the USSR. But things really started getting dangerous, as we'll see, from March 1969. On March 2nd, elite PLA troops ambushed Soviet border guards on Zhenbao Island, also known as Treasure Island. Zhenbao Island, it's an island, it's not out at sea, it's an island inside a river, the River Yuzuri in northeast China, east of Harbin. And the Soviets suffered over 30 dead from that Chinese ambush. And we think, we don't have precise figures, but a similar number of casualties occurred on the Chinese side. The Russians then moved in the days that followed, and they retaliated in force on the night of March 14th to 15th. Bombarding Chinese troops who were on the Chinese bank of the river. In fact, that night, Soviet missiles went up to 20 kilometres into China. So it was, you know, a disproportionate response, you could say. The Soviets clearly meant business, and maybe Mao hadn't been expecting that. Chung Chow, who wrote Wild Swans and also a biography of Mao, estimates that at least 1,800 Chinese were killed. Of course, no official figures were ever released, so we don't know for sure. One CIA photo expert said that the Chinese side of the river was so pockmarked by Soviet artillery that it looked like a moonscape. So obviously things had escalated, and you know, where were they going to stop? The ferocity of this retaliation clearly surprised Mao, and he was becoming worried that the Russians might invade China. And you would think at this point, of course, that he would want to de-escalate the situation. And he did want to.
I was thinking he would try and take revenge. It's Mao.
Well, there is that, yeah. I suppose, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You would think most leaders would want to de-escalate.
Most leaders would want to, yeah.
And to be fair, what happens next isn't entirely Mao's fault. Because at first, when the Soviet premier, Alexei Kosygin, telephoned through on the old hotline from Moscow that hadn't been used for years, the Chinese operator who answered it said they could not receive a call for Chairman Mao from, to open quotes, that scoundrel revisionist Kosygin. So the operator refused to put through the Soviet premier, so Mao didn't even get the chance to not talk to him. But the next day, to be fair to Mao, he heard about this and he immediately told the Chinese Foreign Ministry to inform Moscow that China was ready to hold diplomatic negotiations.
Just sounds like a very bad drama, doesn't it?
Well, isn't that what what history is?
It is, yeah.
I've got lots of bad dramas on my website, on paulletters.com. There's so many stories about this from different parts of modern history.
Missing the message, got it the next day, but the mood is completely changed.
Exactly, yeah. The accidents of history. It's maybe what I enjoy writing about and here speaking about more than anything. And my novel, A Chance Kill, really plays on that, just the chances of this happening when, of course, it does happen in reality. Anyway, back to 1969. So Mao, by this point, did want to avoid a full-blown war because obviously China would have lost at this point to the Soviet Union. But through the spring and summer of 1969, China was preparing, was mobilising their armed forces in case they were needed. And millions of Chinese were moved from areas that bordered the USSR. People in cities across China were organised to dig deep tunnels in which to shelter from possible nuclear attack. In Beijing, the tunnel system built for Mao and his officials running through the heart of the capital under Tiananmen Square. It was wide enough for four cars abreast to travel through and included a major hospital all underground. In fact, in Beijing as a whole, the network of tunnels apparently was large enough for the entire population of the city and they could live in there for weeks. Further border clashes occurred in the summer of 1969, this time along the western section of the Sino-Soviet border in Xinjiang, on the border with what's today Kazakhstan, part of the Soviet Union then, of course. There, the Russians had overwhelming military advantages. They were kind of choosing the spot now, the Russians, for the clash. And an armoured Russian force advanced far into China with little to slow them down. And so Mao had little in the way of anti-tank weapons, especially limited weapons in general in that area. And he must have been worried that the Russians might make it all the way to Beijing. In 1964, Mao had issued an order to pile up some mountains if there aren't any there, thinking ahead to possible invasion by the Soviets. This was to make man-made mountains to block Russian tanks. So they designed hundreds of these mountains, about 20 to 40 metres high. So they call mountains, but, you know, mounds might be a better description. But they were up to several hundred metres in circumference, made out of earth and rocks that had been moved hundreds of miles. And they began constructing these before the project was later abandoned. Everyone who saw the mountains, including the CIA, obviously spying, they judged them to be utterly useless. And so the Soviets were able, of course, to make considerable headway. And it's at this time in the summer going into autumn 1969 that there's the possibility of a nuclear strike from the Soviet Union on China's nuclear facilities. In the early 1960s, the US had sounded out the Soviets to see if there was any interest in possible joint action against China. China was then just beginning to develop its nuclear program. And now in 1969, the Soviets were wondering how the US would react if the USSR attacked China's nuclear facilities. Mao was worried, so he invited, to try and obviously preempt anything like that, he invited the Soviet Premier Kosygin to stop over in Beijing, this is September 69, on his way back from the funeral of Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi. Zhou Enlai met him, but Kosygin would not promise that Russia would not attack China, so this obviously just makes Mao and their leadership even more worried. The Soviets basically saying, yeah, it's an option, we might attack China's nuclear facilities. And this was leaked through, and this information was leaked through a UK newspaper that the Kremlin was apparently discussing bombing Mao's nuclear facilities, and planning, the Kremlin was also planning to set up an alternative leadership for the Chinese Communist Party, one that would be more to their liking. So of course Mao is increasingly worried. The entire armed forces, whose training had somewhat lapsed since the start of the Cultural Revolution in 1966, were put on red alert, which involved mobilizing over 4,000 Chinese military aircraft, 600 ships, and almost a million troops. And then just at this time, when Russia has mobilized its own armed forces, it's moved its fleet into a position off China's coast in October 1969, in an incredible coincidence, President Nixon decided to scare Russia from supporting North Vietnam. It's during the Vietnam War, of course, at this exact same time as Russia is poised to strike China. So President Nixon calls a nuclear alert, which he keeps secret from the public, to tell Russia that he was so mad about their support for North Vietnam that he might use nuclear weapons against them. He kept the alert secret from the US public because of the anti-war protests that by 1969 were vociferous, and if news of a possible nuclear strike by America on the Soviet Union actually got out, that of course that might increase the protesters and the demonstrations. So this secret alert that President Nixon gave was called the Madman Nuclear Alert.
Stay tuned for an incredible guest who will tell us how his intervention in the conflict probably changed history.
Oh boy, do we have a very special guest joining us. Well, first of all, in the studio we have Paul Letters, author and historian, and also Paul has worked very hard to get a very special guest. I'll tell you what, I'll pass the ball over to Paul.
Yeah, I'm not a special guest, but Bruce Gordon is joining us all the way from Kentucky, USA. How are you, Bruce?
I'm doing fine, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. I know you've spent a fair bit of your life in the Asia-Pacific region. I wonder if you could tell us, particularly to begin with, about where and when you grew up.
Yes, I was born in the Philippine Islands, in Manila, actually. And my father noticed that there was a war coming, so he asked that we be moved to the safety of an American place. So we went to Hawaii, and I managed to be in Honolulu during the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. I spent most of my childhood in the Hawaiian Islands during the war, and after the war, I came to Hong Kong, where my father was the manager of the Eastman Kodak Company, and I went to a KG-5 school.
So you moved to Hawaii, your parents moved the family there to be safer and get away as the Japanese were attacking China in the 1930s. And as you say, you were there on December 7th, 1941.
Yes.
But as a boy growing up, what did you make of what was going on, these huge events?
Well, I was 7 years old when the attack came on Pearl Harbor, and as a little boy, I was doing little boy things. I was out playing on the beach when my mother came running and said, come home immediately, come home, the Japanese are attacking Pearl Harbor. Wow. And I didn't know anything, so I went home and there was a complete uproar there, and that's a story in itself.
I want to jump in here, Bruce, and ask you, what did you think of Hong Kong, and what was it like coming to school here?
Well, it was very interesting. The Hong Kong was a melange of many different nationalities and peoples, and KG5 school was also a great place of many nationalities. There were Chinese there, there were British there, there was even a couple of Russians that came by, and I had some American friends, and we played cricket, which I had never played before, and we played a lot of British football, and I learned to add, subtract, multiply, and divide in pounds, shillings, and pence, which I thought was very interesting to try.
Very colonial, indeed. How many years in total did you spend in Hong Kong?
Only about 3 years.
I
was not the greatest student, but I enjoyed being there and seeing all these things. The British ships were there, and American ships came in and visited. I was very thrilled with the American, with the ships going on to aircraft carriers and seeing the planes on the decks and actually being able to climb into the cockpits. And KG-5 school was right beside Kai Tak Airport, and we had Spitfires taking off and landing there, and that was quite exciting to a young boy.
So the listener can tell where you get this passion from for the military side of things, particularly aircraft and flying. And I can also recommend for Bruce's book, The Spirit of Attack, which covers all of this with some fantastic stories in it. There's links to this on my website on paulletters.com. If you click on the History Radio Show tab, you'll see a picture of Bruce there and a link to his book and a bit of more information. You said earlier you weren't the best student, but I know that you went on to college in the US and then into a career in the US Air Force. Can you tell us a little about that, please?
Yes, I went to the Air Force Reserve Officers Training Corps, that's ROTC, at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts. And there they had a very good program on military history, and I loved military history. When I graduated, I went into pilot training, and they had very good training on mechanics and aviation and electronics. And I became quite an expert in radar, and later I became an expert in electronic warfare, jamming and all that sort of thing. And then I went up to Alaska and flew against the Russians in Alaska. They were flying around Point Barrow. I went out over the Arctic Ocean chasing Russians. I chased them along the Bering Sea, and we encountered them sometimes, but they were always in legal places. And as long as planes are in international airspace over international waters, we'd fly along beside them and wave at them, and they would wave back at us, and nothing happened. We had sort of a good understanding with the Russians that we didn't shoot at them and they didn't shoot at us.
Sorry, Bruce, just a quick question. Is it true what they say? You need to have sort of 20/20 vision to become a pilot, and let alone a fighter pilot.
Yes, indeed. It's amazing what your eyeball can pick up. The jamming can jam radar, but as you're flying along, you can notice a thin trail of smoke in the air and notice that a plane has been there. You can catch a little glint of sunlight reflecting off of a canopy. You can see a plane far away. If you can see the other guy before he sees you, you can start maneuvering early, and that's very important. So, yes, you have to have very good eyesight. You also have to have a good what we call situational awareness. Be aware of what is going on around you. What is the young pilots are so busy flying the airplane that they don't look at what's going on and understand that, And that helped me very much in the future things that I encountered, including the situations in Korea.
Yes, I gather a lot of your operational flying was, well, during the Vietnam War, and then after that, during the Vietnam War, but based out of Osan in South Korea. Before you joined us today, we were talking about how the USSR was preparing to strike China's nuclear facilities in 1969. And I mentioned President Nixon and the madman nuclear alert. And I wonder if you could tell us about your first-hand experience of that crisis situation.
Yes, I was in Korea, Osan, Korea, in October 1969, just as the madman nuclear alert kicked off. Of course, we weren't told that it was a madman nuclear alert. We gave it that name afterwards. But we were told there was a secret military exercise, and which was strange because military exercises are never secret. So how could we have a secret military exercise? And in most military exercises, we fly as much as we can. In this case, we are told we could not fly at all for any reason. We couldn't even run up the engines of the airplanes on the airfield to do maintenance. Huh. Our supply planes couldn't even come in. This was the strangest alert I had ever heard of, and the South Korean workers were not allowed to come on base. And I think if this is a secret, why any spy in the world could tell what we were doing. We weren't flying. There was no noise around the base. And then it occurred to me that this was visible to the Russians easily, but was not visible to the American public. And this alert went on for a week or so, and then suddenly we got a scramble. The horn went off, and I ran to my plane, got in my fighter, and I took off, and was given directions to fly east first along the border with North Korea onto the Sea of Japan, and I flew north a bit after a Russian plane. The Russian plane could be there. We weren't really too excited about him. You know, it's open international airspace, but we always let them know we're around. So we flew out there toward the Russian plane, and he turned around and went back to Vladivostok. As I turned around and was going to go home, I looked down and saw a fleet of ships underneath me. It was a fleet of warships. I could see they were very sleek ships. They looked well, but I didn't think they were American ships. I asked for permission to go down for a look. I got permission. And I dove down to the ships. As I came down toward the ships, I noticed that they were basically dead in the water. They were stopped. And there was a fishing boat leaving the Russian ships. I could tell they were Russian now. They're leaving the Russian ships at high speed. Now, this fishing boat was leaving a big wake in the bow and a big stern wake, and I'm thinking fishing boats don't go fast. They go putt, putt, putt. They don't have big engines.
So it wasn't quite what it seemed.
No, it was surprising to me. So I turned toward the fishing boat first. As I came toward the fishing boat, he suddenly slowed down. He knew he wasn't supposed to be going fast as a fishing boat. He slowed down and went putt, 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 putt along like a normal fishing boat. And I flew over it, and I couldn't see anything on it. No, I couldn't see anybody on deck. So I turned toward the Russian ships. There were seven of them. And as I turned toward them, I set up my flight path. So I was, first of all, slowing down and getting as slow as I could and fairly close to the water. And I flew past the smaller ships. They were nice-looking ships. And then I set myself on the main ship, which I believe now was a cruiser Sverdlovsk. And I put my plane on autopilot so that I could have my hands free to take pictures of it as I went by. I had a camera, an Air Force camera, and I looked through the lens, a telephoto lens, and I could see that it looked like the crew was lined up on the deck. There were brown shirts lining up on the deck, on the bottom decks, and white shirts on the top decks in the along the bridge.
So we're coming back to that amazing eyesight that you had to see that detail.
Well, I could see them, and also situational awareness. I was aware of all these things that were happening. And then I became aware of the fact that they suddenly turned the big guns of that cruiser right at me.
Whoa.
And I'm looking through here I am slow, low, and on autopilot, and looking through the viewfinder of my camera, and I'm looking into the barrels of these big guns. And I said, whoa, I know what I'm not like. So they didn't want me there, so I agreed with them real quickly. I grabbed my controls and broke off and lit the afterburner and zoomed back up to the safety of high altitude. And as I got there, I got a radio call, return to the base and report to the commander immediately. So I said, okay, I thought I'd seen something pretty interesting. So I went right back to Osan, and as quickly as I could, I gave the camera to the intelligence people, told them to be really careful with it, and I went right to the command post. And when I got there, there were some people in the command post, and the commander gave an order, and all the other people immediately left. And I was left there with just the commander and me in the command post. And he said, Major, hit a brace. Well, that's what you do in training when you get chewed out. Well, I hit a brace against the wall, and he started chewing me out like a professional. I've never been chewed out like that before. He thought I was the greatest idiot that had ever got into the Air Force. And what did I think I was doing? That I was meddling in something much bigger than me.
Had he been alerted somehow, or how did he know you were? I suppose you got permission earlier to fly over there, but how did he know how close you got?
Well, he knew because he was in the command post that they had picked me out, that the Russian plane had been there, that they had scrambled me out. So he knew all about that and knew about my call. I had asked for permission to go down and look, and a lieutenant had given me permission, because I wouldn't have gone down without permission, but the colonel said that the lieutenant had no authority to give me permission to go down. So he said he was going to settle things with the lieutenant later. But right now he had me, and he was very angry. And when I told him what I had seen, he had me sit down and write out a report, which he immediately sent to the Pentagon. And what I told him I had seen was what I thought was a meeting of top-level North Korean commanders with Russians at sea just off of the east coast of North Korea. I didn't know at that time about the situation between China and Russia, and that Russia may have been planning to attack China. I did not know that at all. I did not know about this madman nuclear alert, that this was part of a big thing in the world. All I knew is what I saw. I saw the little fishing boat had probably come out to the Russian fleet and delivered the North Korean negotiators or commanders to talk to the Russians, and was taking them home back to North Korea just when I came by. All those people lined up on the decks were there to say goodbye to a very important person.
So what do you think the Russians were made of your sort of reconnaissance, spying on them from their point of view?
Well, they undoubtedly would never think that a pilot would do that just on his own. They must have thought that I was ordered to do that by President Nixon himself. And this may have been a warning to the Russians not to attack China, because America would not stand for a attack on China. Now, as far as I know, Nixon never talked to the Russians about the attack, but sometime later, I saw a report in the London Telegraph that said that Kosygin and Brezhnev had been talking, and that Kosygin told Brezhnev that the Americans had betrayed us. So I don't know if my flight over the Russian ships was possibly seen by the Russians as an indication that America would not tolerate an attack on China. Of course, it really wasn't anything else. It was just me going down to have a look at something that looked interesting.
Maybe what you did indirectly saved China from an attack from Russia.
It's possible. It's possible. I can't prove it. But I know what I saw. I know what I did. And now we know more about the madman nuclear alert that was going on that had nothing to do with China. But Nixon didn't tell the Russians why he was having the madman nuclear alert. He didn't tell us why he was doing the madman nuclear alert. None of us knew what was going on, so we just did what we were told. And I stumbled into a major meeting of North Korea and Russia talking about something at this critical moment. And the Russians must have taken it as a warning.
It's quite amazing timing, and it fascinates me as a historian how we get these often coincidences in history which have such a big impact. In this case, possibly saving China and beyond from a possible nuclear strike, possible nuclear war.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at this. That's all the time we have for today. But thank you so much for sharing your invaluable story and your findings as well. And like I said, maybe you indirectly saved China from the attacks from Russia.
Well, thanks very much, Bruce.
Thank you very much. See you later.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
For anyone just joining us in the middle of that call from U.S. Fighter pilot Bruce Gordon, we've been talking about 1969 and how close China came to war with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was preparing to attack China. We may never know how close it really got, and whether it would have happened. But Bruce's involvement there and his insight was fantastic. From Mao's point of view, from this point onwards, from the autumn 1969, he wanted to calm things down. He was really getting the message now to be friendlier to the Russians, no doubt regretting provoking them in March 1969, but with his attack of PLA troops that we mentioned earlier, attacking the Soviets on the Chinese-Soviet border in March 69. But by the end of the year, he was going out of his way to be friendly to the Soviet Union, and they developed what became known as the friendly neighbor relations with Russia, and they restored their formal diplomatic relations in 1970, so exchanging ambassadors and so on. So that was really the peak of the crisis that we heard about there from Bruce on the line from America.
Hey, thanks for listening. You can get in touch on Facebook through the This Month in History page and through my webpage, poorletters.com, where you'll find my wartime novels and my World War II 75 Years On daily Twitter feed. Click subscribe on the podcast and get every episode automatically downloaded, all for free. And please write a review or give us a star rating. That makes iTunes bump us up their browsing pages. Thanks again for your support. We couldn't do this without it.